So I always wonder, I know why I'm motivated to study things I'm interested in, but I always wonder when it comes to morality and ethics, why somebody would want to study that particular topic. And I always bring in the Freudian aspect that, you know, did something happen to them in their childhood where they wanted to kind of figure out what was going on, or why people made decisions, or why people are immoral. So what got you into this particular area of study?
My study of ethics and of philosophy in general was really motivated by my study and interest in the Bible. I had learned biblical stories and biblical texts, you know, throughout my early educational career, and I was just really troubled by a lot of narratives in the Bible where characters act in less than ethically optimal ways in very questionable scenarios. And I wanted to try to understand what the Bible is really trying to teach. And so I used philosophy, specifically ethics and moral philosophy, to try to decipher the lessons that were, you know, intended to learn from these, you know, challenging biblical stories.
Yeah, so you said it there, is these stories are meant to teach something. So I guess there's a presumption about the stories that, as you well know, not everybody in biblical scholarship shares, is that these stories teach. So I guess, was that a presumption you always had, or the more you looked at them, you saw that that was obvious? Or?
No, I think in the traditional way I was educated, the Bible was to be understood as a living source of ethical guidance. And so I wanted to understand how these episodes are really, you know, supposed to be interpreted. And when I say what lessons are supposed to be extracted from the Bible, I don't personally feel that there's one mm-hmm. particular lesson to be extracted. In a number of my works, I really just try to focus on the ethical ambiguity within these texts and the numerous different interpretations that can be advanced through different ethical considerations and through different philosophical positions.
Yeah, I want to come back to that in a minute, but first I want to talk about how you were raised to read the Bible.
I was raised in a traditional educational system, and certainly in such educational environments, different classical exegetes are used to help interpret the Bible in general, but particularly challenging texts within the Bible. And I think what I've tried to do in my courses, in my writing, is really show that there's a whole host of different perspectives and cogent interpretations, mm-hmm. and much of, I work on biblical narrative, but much of the Bible is written in a very ambiguous way, and it's open to diverse interpretations. And so I've had many students in my classes, also, you know, educated in traditional environments, that were troubled by particular texts. And, you know, through ethical analyses of these texts, they were able to kind of push aside traditional assumptions. Mm-hmm. And they were able to read the text in a different way, in a more critical way. They were able to see different perspectives to understand the motivations or the actions of particular biblical characters and get a better understanding of, you know, challenging stories.
Hmm. We're talking today with Dr. Shira Weiss. She is a former fellow at the Herzl Institute, and she has been a fellow at Ben-Gurion University in Israel, and she's currently working at the Frisch School in Paramus, is that correct?
Yes.
And she's written a few books, both with Oxford and Cambridge University Presses, on the issues of ethics and the biblical narrative. And I wonder that issue of, you said a lot of interesting things there that we'll have to unpack. Ethical ambiguity, right? So maybe we can talk about one particular story, maybe one of your favorite ones that you really think communicates this in a punchy way. And why is ethical ambiguity not necessarily the boogeyman, the bad guy here, but actually might do something good for us in thinking through ethical issues?
I think ethical ambiguity is embedded in moral conflict in general. I think there is competing tensions, competing values that are inherent in moral conflict. And I think that both when you read an ethically challenging narrative in the Bible and also when you encounter a moral dilemma in life, I think there's no easy resolution and it needs to be understood through many different considerations from many different perspectives in order for one to be able to navigate, you know, through a moral conflict. And I think you see that with biblical examples in challenging scenarios, and I think you see that in contemporary life. Mm-hmm. An example of a biblical story where you see an ethical challenge is in the hardening of Pharaoh's heart. I wrote about it in a number of different books. And a more traditional reading of that text is a more literal reading that God deprived Pharaoh of his free choice, and therefore Pharaoh was unable to liberate the Israelites. But that, of course, becomes ethically challenging, because why then would God punish Pharaoh, or would Pharaoh be punished? It's not clear whether God punished him, but whether would it be appropriate, would it be just for Pharaoh to be punished if he didn't have the free choice when God hardened his heart to liberate the Israelites?
So there's an alternate story that could have gone. He hardened his heart so that he didn't liberate them, but then he liberated them anyways, and there was no punishment. There was no death and destruction, and whether Pharaoh suffered is another issue. Yeah, so it didn't have to be that way.
Right. And even, you know, even if you do want to say that Pharaoh was, in fact, punished, there's different ways of reading that. So Maimonides, for instance, would say, or one interpretation of a Maimonidean reading would say that God deprived Pharaoh of his free choice as a just punishment for the earlier free decisions that Pharaoh made when he enslaved the Israelites earlier in the narrative. A very different reading is by Joseph Albo, who I wrote my first book about, and he says that rather Pharaoh, taking kind of more of an Aristotelian understanding of it, Pharaoh's earlier free decision habituated his actions. And so God gave Pharaoh, by hardening his heart, the ability to withstand the afflictions of the plagues, and therefore Pharaoh kind of had his free choice restored to him, and he was able to make a free decision of whether or not he should liberate the Israelites, and he chose not to.
Is that just a technical question? Is that based on that the first few instances are in the Hifil, he caused his heart to be hardened, and then later they're in Hophal, or I forget which form they're in?
The language alternates between Pharaoh hardened his heart and Pharaoh's heart was hardened. And then later in the narrative, it says God hardened his heart. But there's one instance after the seventh plague where again it says that Pharaoh's heart was hardened. So there's some discussion, and I write about that. How can we understand that kind of anomalous return to Pharaoh seemingly self-hardening after God had already started to harden his heart? So some of those interpretations kind of rely on that, or use that anomaly, that textual anomaly, to support their view.
So this is a prime example of, well, so I guess where's the ethical ambiguity? I can, all of these center around this issue of you have a hardening, God's involved sometimes, God doesn't seem to be, it seems to be reflexive on Pharaoh, his own heart hardening. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine, especially confessing Christians, they see something like this and they, well, I should say my experience has been in the church is people then say, well, just what's the right answer? Like, what is it, right? And I guess you're going to push us towards, well, there is no it here, but it's actually the story itself is pushing us to think beyond a singular resolution that would have solved all of these problems. Besides the one resolution, which would be Pharaoh just going, okay, go take all of our stuff and leave the country, right?
Yeah. Right. My students ask me that as well. So which one's the right one? What's the right way of reading the Bible? And I argue, you know, that I don't think that there is one right way of reading the Bible. I think, and this is actually even more pertinent in my current work. I'm writing about justice and vigilantism in the Bible. And I'm looking at different cases where a biblical character engages in violence, but for a virtuous goal, one might argue. And so I'm looking at Moses striking the Egyptian and Simeon and Levi attacking the Hivites and Phinehas when he strikes Cosby and Zimri. And I kind of put them on trial, so to speak, and present arguments in prosecution or in defense of their actions. And ultimately, I don't want to make the ruling. I leave it to the reader to kind of assess the cogency of the arguments and to consider all of the ethical considerations in the moral philosophical arguments that I raise. And they can come to an understanding of how to evaluate these characters and their moral conduct. I offer, as I did in my ethical ambiguity book, I offer my own assessments or my own conclusions, you know, at the end of each chapter, but I very much want to leave it open to the interpretations of the reader, and recognizing that the readers are bringing in their own, you know, knowledge and values and, right, and assumptions into it, but I really want to encourage them to look at the text anew and to engage in a close reading and to do a critical analysis, to try to read the text and see in the text that which they might not have seen before.
Yeah, that's got to drive people crazy. I mean, I think it's a really important point, though. I think it is a necessary tool for thinking about the text. And I teach hermeneutics. In fact, I'm teaching a class starting this week on biblical interpretation. And students come into the room with this, there's one right answer. And I guess I want to make sure what we're not hearing you say is that you're not saying, oh, every answer is equally good, right?
Right.
But that there's a plurality that, and this is something I think that's great about the Jewish tradition of interpretation, is it seems hard baked into the Jewish interpretation that there are a plurality of answers or interpretations, and they can mutually enrich each other. And at some point, you have to say, no, this rabbi's wrong, and this one seems better for me, right? But that they can be mutually enriching. And I think there's also a way in which, you know, everything that you're saying about the biblical text, why the biblical narratives for morality, because everybody obviously is going to go to the law and the commandments for morality, right? And then I think you very quickly hit a wall when you go to the commandments. If you think they're just flat commandments, you either do them or break them. Like, it just doesn't seem to operate under that simple system. There's something more rich. And then you get into the stories, and again, they're making things that might seem initially simple, complex. And I think of, here's my own reaction of the examples I bring to the text. I always have young men and women come in and say, well, you were in the military. Should I join the military? You know, what do you think? And I say, look, when you sign on the enlistment papers, I don't know if this is true in the Israeli IDF, but certainly in the American military, you give up your right to make decisions in a lot of, I mean, the only decision you can make is I won't follow an unlawful command. And so I think they go in with the idea, oh, I'm going to be noble, I'm going to be good, I'm going to make the right decisions. And I just have to say, look, in a combat situation, it might be a bunch of really bad decisions you have to make. There is no good. There is no better way out. There's no resolution. There's nothing that brings healing or wholeness. All decisions you make are bad and are going to cause damage to people's bodies and minds and souls at that. So, when I look at the Hebrew Bible, you know, especially as a combat vet, I say, this feels like the real world to me. This doesn't feel like some artificial. Okay, so now here's the hard question. And if you don't want me to include this in the podcast, I will cut it off.
Okay.
What do you then make of, there do seem to be, especially in Hellenistic Judaism, there do seem to be kind of these flatter hero narratives where, you know, the person rises up, Susanna or Tobit, I'm thinking of. I don't know how much you interact with these texts, but where basically they're just good people, they're flat characters, they're just Torah obeisant, but they're not very complex, and the moral ambiguity is basically absent. They just need to rise up, fight the enemy, and then they're good, and then be like them seems to be the moral of the story. What do you think about that?
I mean, I can't speak because I haven't studied them to a great extent, but I know there are some people that read the Bible in that way, especially, yes. And this is something that I, you know, spoke about in my last book, and I'm also thinking about this book, you know, because God praises Phineas, he, you know, and you know, rewards him with this, you know, covenant of peace. People read him as a, you know, exclusively virtuous character and a hero. In fact, I'm entitling the book Biblical Heroes on Trial. Moses is, you know, considered by the Bible the greatest leader. The end of the Bible talks about how nobody as great as Moses, you know, has ever existed or will. So I think that there are people who read the Bible and don't necessarily focus on the complexity of the characters or even question their moral conduct because they're deemed to be heroic. I think I have a chapter in my previous book on ethical ambiguity on whether or not it's ethical to lie or deceive. And so I looked at a lot of different cases of this throughout the Bible, but some of them I looked at individuals who were praised, like the midwives in Egypt, and Rahab in the book of Joshua. And I, even if they're praised or rewarded for their conduct, it doesn't necessarily mean that the way they went about achieving their goal was ethical, even if ultimately their goal was virtuous. And so those are the types of things I try to decipher when looking at it. And even in that chapter about deception, I even looked at God. There's a number of different instances in the Bible where God instructs or encourages lying or deception. And is that really the ethical ideal? Could there have been a better way that Moses could have approached Pharaoh without deceiving him that he would only take the Israelites out on a 3-day journey? So there's a lot of ambiguity, and I think it doesn't necessarily disparage the biblical characters when you look at them as multifaceted beings with competing tensions and varying values in motivating their conduct.
Yeah, and it seems that if Torah means instruction in the kind of broadest sense, and the narrative is meant to instruct as well, then this what this all tells us is this is not aiming at, there's just this right way to be and just be that way and just do this thing, yes, no, when you hit this fork in the road. But it's actually, everything you're saying to me sounds like moral discernment. It's training people to discern fine nuances, not holding up an ideal model of just be this person, but like, hey, there's going to be really tricky situations and you'll need to navigate away, and you won't always navigate it correctly.
And using these skills in biblical interpretation heightens one's moral sensitivities and moral reasoning that can then be applied to any situation they are confronted with in their life.
So for me, this all sounds like the Hebrew Bible, especially the Torah, is kind of wedged in a long, like a lot of other great traditions of philosophy are aimed at this kind of fine, nuanced discernment, more than a catalog or an encyclopedia of knowledge that you kind of see in the Mesopotamian traditions. Well, thank you very much for your time. This is great. I've actually heard Shira present quite a bit of this work on deception and heroes, and it's absolutely riveting stuff. The book on heroes, do you have a title for that?
It's not. I haven't completed it yet.
Okay.
So it's going to be entitled Biblical Heroes on Trial, Justice and Vigilantism in the Hebrew Bible.
Right.
And it'll complement the previous work on ethical ambiguity in the Hebrew Bible.
And who's that with?
Cambridge.
That's with Cambridge University Press. Yeah. I think just that paradigm of vigilantism, that was a brilliant, brilliant paradigm to bring in, because it's just enough off the radar for most of us that it forces us to rethink everything. So I'm very much looking forward to reading it. Thank you for being a fellow and lending your talents and your voice to the Center for Hebraic Thought. And thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Center for Hebraic Thought podcast. Be sure to subscribe, rate, or leave us a review wherever you found us. Want to learn more about Hebraic Thought? Visit our website at HebraicThought.org.